You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Today's text is from the compact and intense book of Amos. It was written in a time that clearly parallels our own societal and cultural challenges. The folks at the top of the society are experiencing extraordinary economic prosperity, much of which has been made possible by official policies and cultural norms that have disenfranchised the poor and systematically destroyed that period's equivalent of what we'd call the middle class. Enter Amos with warnings to people who are living in a bubble of extravagance, numbness, and denial. People have basically lost the plot and are indifferent to injustices and ignorant of the impact their way of life affects those who are left out. And as our passage today suggests, they've got to be reminded, to be aware of even the most basic of values. Remember good and evil? Look, today's passage is deceptively breezy, but all around it, Amos is bluntly telling the people that A, God is totally fed up with their nonsense, and B, warns them that extreme hardship and disaster awaits them if they don't change their ways. And, spoiler alert, they don't change. So, as punishment from God, their country and way of life is ground to dust, crushed by violent invaders. The moral of the story? When Amos makes a suggestion, listen up.
Our words of wisdom are from Amos, chapter 5, verses 14a and 15a.
Seek good and not evil, and live.
Hate evil and love good, then work it out in the public square.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
One morning in late 1945, President Truman invited the press corps into his office and presented to them a new presidential flag. On it, he pointed out that the eagle, shield on its chest, talons clutching arrows and an olive branch, had been changed. He said, "This new design has the eagle facing the olive branch for peace, rather than the arrows for war. May this seal be symbolic of our nation's dedication to peace, not war." In 1946, Truman proudly pointed out the change to Winston Churchill, who was heard to harumph. "Seems to me that head should be on a swivel." And therein is our problem. And not just for us as a country, but each of us as human beings. We are evolving from primal circumstances that, as a matter of survival, once necessitated our being aggressive and, more often than not, violent. We've even glorified violence by weaving its necessity into our religions and sacred stories. Back in 1250 BCE, the Babylonian creation epic called the Enuma Elish tells how the very order of the universe is established through God-on-God violence, with the defeated deity being dismembered and its corpse strewn about to create various elements of the cosmos. It's a simple story where violence is the means by which even the gods achieve their goals. So why shouldn't we? In his seminal article, The Myth of Redemptive Violence, Walter Wink describes how violence essentially functions as a god itself. Resorting to violence enjoys faithful obedience from its followers, and when all else fails, seems to always come through for us. Wink calls this myth of redemptive violence essentially the original religion of the status quo. It exists to legitimate power and privilege. It perpetuates the value of ideas like peace through war, security through strength, and the notion that fear can only be overcome through domination. The primal rush that comes from violence is so wired into us as human beings, resorting to violence seems almost virtuous. General George Patton thought so. He said, "Compared to war, all other forms of human endeavor shrink to insignificance. God, I love it so." Since 1250 BCE, only the names have changed. The virtue and superiority of violence are gobbled up by young and old alike. Look at our cartoons, comics, video games, and movies. We absorb violence through sports, foreign policy, nationalism, militarism, and judging by the popularity of Lao Tzu's Art of War among business people, in our corporatism as well. Violence is entertaining. It's exhilarating. And as Chris Hedges has said so poignantly in his book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, it gives us purpose. Televangelists and fundamentalist Christians use Christianity to perpetuate the myth of redemptive violence too. They can barely conceal their glee over what they anticipate will be the violent, hell-bound fate of all those with whom they disagree. The myth of redemptive violence has so infiltrated our culture that even our language is overwhelmed with a continual drumbeat of violence. From seemingly innocuous phrases like, "Shoot me an email," or "the war on poverty," to "he's the bomb," or even "the fight for peace." I especially like "to beat a dead horse." It's meant to convey futility, but implies that if the horse were alive, violence would lead to success. How do you teach children to not hit one another? You spank them. How do we reinforce our abhorrence of killing? We execute people. How do some advocate defending personal safety? Well, you arm every citizen and shoot to kill. Looking at our whole system, it wouldn't be surprising if you thought that our priorities were violence, not compassion, and death, not life. We're a wholly compromised culture. So it's no wonder that we can't even imagine the existence of many other alternatives. In short, Wink says the myth of redemptive violence, a principle that shapes the whole of humanity, is the simplest, laziest, most exciting, uncomplicated, irrational, and primitive depiction of evil the world has ever known. So what to do? Well, first, we need to arrive at a mutually agreeable goal. Years ago, I had the privilege of visiting Denise Rejeski's dad, Dennis, in the hospital. At the end of our visit, I asked him what he most wanted to pray for, assuming it would be healing, his family, you know, the usual. But no. Here in the last stages of ALS, laboring to speak each syllable, Dennis said, "That the world would be at peace." I don't mean to get all crazy on you or anything, but can we agree that that's a noble goal? Well, How would we even begin? Amos knows. Seek good and not evil, and live. Hate evil and love good, then work it out in the public square. And how do we do that? By recommitting ourselves to something that most Christians don't even realize is at the heart of the Christian faith: nonviolence. One of the most ardent proponents of Christian nonviolence in our day has, of course, been Martin Luther King Jr., who, despite the insults, beatings, and imprisonment, refused to respond with violence. While King could point to Jesus as the inspiration for nonviolence, he learned its practical expression from a Hindu, Mahatma Gandhi, who in turn learned it from Jesus. It's said that a reporter once asked Gandhi, "Why do you spend so much time reading from the Bible and quoting the New Testament?" Gandhi replied, "Well, it seems that Christianity is a really good idea. It just hasn't really been put into practice yet." Gandhi believed that at the root of every conflict, there is untruth, and that the only permanent solution was truth. So he conceived the practice of what's called satyagraha, combining satya, truth, with agraha, firmness. Gandhi advocated the unwavering search for the truth. He was convinced that the only way of getting to truth is through love, and that the only practical definition of love is when the security and well-being of the other person becomes as important as your own. Sounds awfully Jesus-y of him, doesn't it? The practice of relentless, nonviolent resistance seems kind of pie in the sky to many, and maybe so. Nonviolence doesn't always lead to victory in the pedestrian sense, but it means practicing the discipline of refraining from violence, of the fist, of the heart, and of the tongue.
So you just want all of us to give up and be doormats in a dangerous world?
No. But if answering Amos' call to resist evil and do good is important enough, then dying for it, as both Gandhi and King did, might be a real possibility. Our culture has been and will continue to be awash in depictions of and the use of violence as the ultimate solution to our conflicts. Our politics, our interactions online, and more so in person, seem to be driven by a sense of grievance and vengeance. And too many American Christians are fixated on believing things about Jesus rather than emulating the witness of Jesus' life and teachings, which model a paradigm so different, some people can't even imagine it. Jim Lawson recounts the day in 1937 or 38 when his mom asked him to run an errand for him in their small southern town. As he walked down the street, a white boy in a parked car rolled down the window, leaned his whole body out of the car, and shouted, calling Jim the N-word at the top of his lungs. Jim, only 9 or 10 years old himself, proceeded to walk over to the car and calmly, but soundly, slapped the boy's face. And then just as calmly, moved on to complete his errand. Back home in his mother's kitchen, Jim recounted to her what happened. She wasn't angry, but with stillness and a loving voice, asked, "Jimmy, what good did that do?" She then proceeded to recount the core values of their Methodist family: love of God, love for one another, life in the church, and most of all, practicing what we've learned from Jesus. His mother continued by reminding him that no mean words could ever take away his status before God and family. "I love you," she said, "and we love you." And her last sentence proved to be a decisive moment in Lawson's young life. "Jimmy, there must be a better way." As it turned out, that moment launched Lawson's lifelong search for the better way. And despite constant racism and discrimination, with plenty of opportunities to slap, shove, and swing his fists in retaliation, he used his head, heart, and voice to promote Jesus' admonition to resist the urge to violence and harness the power of turning the other cheek. He went on to not only read Gandhi in college, he traveled to India as a Methodist missionary and learned firsthand from practitioners of Gandhi's Satyagraha in confronting evil nonviolently. Upon returning to the U.S., he not only became a colleague of Martin Luther King's, he went on to become the leading theoretician and tactician of the whole civil rights movement. Although you've probably never heard of him, MLK called Lawson the architect of the civil rights movement. And he was instrumental in organizing the sit-ins, marches, and the strategy of the Freedom Riders that made the whole movement a success. As a Methodist pastor in Memphis, Lawson invited MLK to come speak to the Memphis sanitation workers, where King delivered his "I've Been to the Mountaintop" sermon, and then was assassinated the very next day. Yet, even in the face of such profound violence, Lawson would remind his fellow Jesus followers, "Just because someone wrongs you, you don't have the right to then wrong your assailant. You may have the power to get even, but God does not give you the right to do so, nor do you have the right to imitate the evil that led to the assault upon you." Jesus follows Amos in calling us away from the imitation of evil and reminding us that even though we are called to hate evil and love good and to establish justice in the public square, violence is never an option. Lawson has written, "Jesus knew that an eye for an eye, hatred for hatred, and slap for slap exalted the wrong, and in fact undermined the right. By imitating the evil that one experiences, you can sabotage your own gift of life." He knew that nonviolence is not only the better way to resist prejudice, racism, and evil. Nonviolence is the only way. As this weekend marks Jim Lawson's 95th birthday, I wanted you to be able to join in with people across the country who are recognizing his extraordinary contribution to the civil rights movement, social justice, and the principle of nonviolent resistance. As he served in Los Angeles as a Methodist pastor for 25 years, leading countless efforts to improve the lives of the excluded and dispossessed, the LA City Council declared just this week that henceforth, September 22nd would be celebrated annually as James Lawson Jr. Day. Despite the profound setbacks, despite the violence that Lawson experienced, he never wavered from his commitment to what his mother called the better way, the power of nonviolence, to not only resist evil, but in time, melt away the hostility of those who feel violence is the only way to resolve conflict. And as Episcopal saint and fellow icon of the civil rights movement, Polly Murray said, "While I could not always suppress the violent thoughts that raged inside me, I would nevertheless dedicate my life to seeking alternatives to physical violence and would wrestle continually with the problem of transforming psychic violence into creative energy." What Murray knew and practiced, what Lawson, Gandhi, and so many others knew, is that Jesus inaugurated a new order based on compassion, equality, and understanding, undergirded by the creative energy of relentless nonviolence. 14 years ago this weekend, peace activist Arun Gandhi, grandson of Mahatma Gandhi and founder of the M.K. Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence, came to the fountains to offer a blessing in dedicating our peace pole. I still can't believe that we had the privilege of hosting Gandhi's grandson. Arun reminded us that we no longer live in primal circumstances, but in complex relationships, and our very survival as a species can no longer depend on violence. Our survival depends on hating evil, yes, loving the good, yes, and then working out our differences in the public square with a thoroughgoing commitment to nonviolence. And how does Gandhi suggest we succeed? We have to change ourselves if we want to change the world. It begins with us. Lord have mercy. Be well.